Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Sam Roberts knows New York City. He's been writing about it for 50 years now, 35 of those at the New York Times. Mr. Roberts' latest book celebrates the city's four-plus century history in a unique way through the stories of its physical structures, exploring the DNA of the city by examining a number of buildings, some iconic, some relatively unknown, each encapsulating the era's events and aspirations of its population over the centuries. A History of New York in 27 Buildings is published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sam Roberts to our show now. Welcome.
Leonard, thank you for having me.
And I guess this is a follow-up to some degree for your History of New York in 101 Objects.
Well, it is. I did a book called Only in New York, which sort of told the story of the city through people. And then I did A History of New York in 101 Objects, looking at artifacts. And I did a book called Grand Central, which sort of told this story in one building. And I wondered if you could look at an accumulation of buildings and look at the 400-year history of the city and tell it through bricks and mortar.
Although you're limited yourself to 27 buildings. Later, we'll talk about some of the buildings that didn't make it. But do people know you in different ways, depending on how they meet you? For example, reading the Times or seeing you on television. You have a podcast as well?
Yeah, I've been doing a podcast on and off. We did one on presidential politics, and we did one called Only in New York as well. I guess people do, and people think of me as something of an expert on New York history, but frankly, I learn something about New York every day, and that's what I love so much about covering the city.
You've been writing obituaries recently, and I think we can say that New York is not dying. In fact, if anything, there's a lot of new construction, although so much of it is undistinguished.
Well, that's true. And another reason to look at buildings, too, and also obituaries. You know, when I started writing them a couple of years ago, it wasn't something I really liked to get into. I'm not a big fan of death, to tell you the truth. But then I realized, particularly after I started writing them, that obituaries are not about death.
No, they're biographies.
They are biographies. There's one sentence that says somebody died, and the rest are really about people's lives. And they're about people's lives for the most part, people who I never met. And when I write about them, I realize how much I would have liked to meet them.
So did you approach the buildings with the same sensibility?
Well, exactly, Leonard, because what I did was try to make these biographies of buildings. Winston Churchill said that we shape our buildings and thereafter they shape us. And to a great extent, I think that's true. After all, buildings are built by people and they take on lives of their own.
But you have a very specific definition of buildings for the purposes of this book.
Yes, they have to exist, so I left out the ones that didn't. I wanted them to be quirky, so there are very few that are the kind of buildings you would find on postcards, in tourist guides. Obviously, I included some that are so iconic you couldn't possibly leave them out, like the Empire State Building.
But also other kinds that people might not think of as buildings, like the Coney Island Boardwalk.
That's right. There are a couple I snuck in that may not qualify exactly as buildings, more like structures. But I wanted them to be provocative and to make people think about how to define buildings and to look at history in different ways. Because frankly, I don't think we as New Yorkers think enough about our history. And history is very important.
And I assume you also thought about having to reveal some new aspects of a familiar building to make it something worthwhile to read.
Well, that's right. And
fun facts, in effect.
Yeah, well, one of the things I love about reporting is doing the research. I don't find myself to be that facile a writer, but I love doing the research. And of course, the more research you do, the longer you can delay having to write. And you just find all sorts of facts the more research that you plunge into.
What's the value of examining history through something as concrete, usually impersonal as a building?
Well, usually when you look at buildings, you find out there are people behind all of them. Who built them? Why did they build them? What were the reasons behind them? Who paid for them? Who designed them? Again, they are accumulations of bricks and mortar and glass, but they were built by people.
And you quote Ayn Rand, who wrote, "Buildings have integrity like men, and just as seldom."
Just as seldom, indeed. It was a great Ayn Rand quote.
Well, there had to be at least one or two great quotes from Ayn Rand. Is there meaning to be seen in buildings, or do we have to project it there?
I think there is meaning. Some of them in actually the shape of buildings and why they were built the way they were. Some of it in what buildings stood for and what buildings have become. I mean, we constantly recycle our city. So there's meaning in the buildings that we saved. There's meaning in the buildings that we lost. Penn Station, for instance, didn't die in vain. It gave us the Landmarks Law and allowed us to preserve so many other buildings that we have with us today.
Some great photographs.
Yes, indeed.
But where you look at the photographs and say, oh, they knocked that down.
That's right. Absolutely. What a gorgeous place. And, to think of that having been lost is horrible. But because of that, we have Grand Central Terminal, which is also a great public space.
And if you go into Grand Central, you will see many, many people with their phones up taking pictures. It is something that out-of-towners consider one of the great pleasures of New York, or one of the great beauties of New York.
It is a majestic
space. People want to be photographed in it.
That's right. And just photographing the ceiling, I love standing on the balcony and watching the choreography of people walking in that main concourse and never bumping into each other. It's a remarkable feat.
Oh, well, you're luckier than I am. I get there all the time. People are bumping into each other all the time. Buildings also reflect the time they were built in. So we can often spot a building from a certain era.
Well, you can.
So it's a matter of tastes, or?
Yeah, this is not an architecture book. It's more of a history book. I'm not an expert in architecture, but it talks about why buildings were built. For instance, the Empire State Building, everybody wanted to build the tallest building in the world at that time. And the fact that this was built really at the very beginning of the Depression suggests a certain faith in the future of the city, suggests a certain ego on the part of the people who were building it, and an ego that might have been misplaced since the building really didn't make money for years.
Is it true that it began in a men's room?
Well, so we hear that Al Smith was in a men's room complaining that he was out of work. He didn't have a job. He had lost the presidential election. And in comes John Raskob, who was his campaign manager and treasurer, and says basically—
DuPont and General Motors.
Yes, and General Motors, and says basically, "Don't worry, Al, I'm about to build the tallest building in the world, and I'm going to make you the president." And he did.
And
he also, in effect, made Al Smith a conservative and almost a Republican in the process.
So were very tall buildings a personification of the Roaring Twenties and the general feeling of optimism?
I think they were. And when you look at the number that went up in the 20s, it's absolutely remarkable. The skyscraper kind of started in Chicago, but it really mushroomed in New York. And you look at the number, and it's just incredible. And when you look at the Empire State Building today, it is something like the 40-whatever-ith tallest in the world. But I defy anyone to name the, 30 others that are taller.
One or two in Chicago.
Yeah, in Chicago or in Dubai.
Sri Lanka.
Right. But it is so iconic. It is so beautiful. I mean, you think of King Kong. You think of Deborah Kerr saying it's the closest we have to heaven. I mean, it just takes on a mythology all its own that makes it integral to New York in a way no other building can be.
So did the stock market crash impede Raskob from his plans to build the Empire State Building?
Not at all. I mean, he clearly had shepherded his money. He had it in stock, and he had it hidden away. And that building went up in a year and a half.
Did he have a specific height that he was aiming for?
High. each time he went higher, because he was competing early on with the Chrysler Building and 40 Wall Street, which was the Bank of Manhattan building. Now it is a Trump building. And he wanted to make sure whatever height they reached, and they were fighting with each other until the Chrysler Building stuck that spire through the roof and beat 40 Wall. Whatever they were, he wanted to be higher. And builders told him, 86 stories is really too high. You're not going to make more money than that. But finally, he went up to 102 and beat everybody. And of course, until the early 70s, when the World Trade Center was built, that was the tallest building in New York.
Well, many people have said that they think the Chrysler Building is a prettier building and better looking building. How important was the architectural look of the Empire State Building? And didn't it have a blimp more on the top?
It did. That was sort of a pretentious conceit, and it was used only twice because it just wasn't very practical at all. Too windy, too difficult to get on and off it. It was used, I think, to deliver mail and newspapers twice right after the building opened. I think the building is so beautiful in part because it stands alone in that section of 34th Street. The Chrysler Building is unquestionably a gorgeous structure. James Sanders writes that the Chrysler Building is everyone's best supporting building in the city.
And it's right across the street from Grand Central, so that helps.
Of course. But it does get a little clustered and crowded in some of the buildings around it. But now that the spire is lit, I think it is one of the most beautiful buildings in the city, for sure. And one that, unfortunately, I left out of the book. People complain. But again, the idea of the book was to make people think and be provocative.
What was the public's reaction when the Empire State Building was finished?
Amazement, really. People were stunned. A lot of people thought it was ugly. You know, what is this big, now we talk about finger buildings sticking up on 57th Street. Well, they sort of thought
now
of that.
Now, they are
then.
Ugly.
They are ugly, except the one on Park Avenue, which I have now either grown accustomed to or looks good compared to the others. But the Empire State Building was an object of awe. And particularly, again, during the Depression, it became a symbol of hope, of what could be accomplished. And the fact that it was accomplished so quickly, when you look at all the things we have built or tried to build since then, it is an amazing feat that was accomplished.
My guest is Sam Roberts, whose latest book is called A History of New York in 27 Buildings, the 400-year untold story of an American metropolis, published by Bloomsbury. How is New York different from old world cities like Paris and London in terms of buildings, other than the fact that it's a lot younger? We only have a 400-year history.
That's right. And you go to Paris and London and you think 400 years, and for them that's, modern. Hmm. We don't have many buildings that are 400 years old. I start in the book with the Bauhaus in Queens, which is symbolic of freedom of religion in this country. And there really are very few that are older than
that.
Well,
you left out the Morris Jamel Mansion, which is the oldest mansion in New York. And Aaron Burr, George Washington slept there, and Aaron Burr lived there.
He did. And, of course, the Hamilton Grange and the Wyckoff House. But, I had to pick some and leave some out. But obviously, the buildings in London and Paris are more historic. They are more charming, one can argue. But we have our own history. And, again, we don't think of it enough. And I remember seeing Alan Bennett's play, The History Boys, and one of the kids is asked to define history. And he stops and thinks for a minute, and he finally says, well, history to me is one damn thing after another. Well, You know,
another phrase that you use is creative destruction.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I think we have let Boston and Philadelphia and to some extent Washington hijack our history. And we forget that New York was the first capital of the United States. And we've got a lot of history that happened right here.
We see a lot of rebuilding and repurposing of buildings in this city. And we talked about the loss of Penn Station. A number of other great buildings have been lost. A friend of mine once lamented when there was talk of knocking down one of the skyscrapers on Park Avenue that she was going to have to picket the around the building, and she had earlier marched around the site when the building that it replaced
that's right
was there. I mean, so
yeah, and it is funny, you know, we come to love buildings that replaced other buildings, and we do constantly recycle them. But, you know, when Lever House went up, for instance, people said, what is this, you know, weird modern structure?
That was the building that I was referring
to. Well,
I
thought maybe it was. And now it is an iconic modern structure on Park Avenue that's too low. It doesn't have the density that developers would like, and they want to replace it.
There's something magical about it, too.
It is.
You credit Jeff Roth in your acknowledgments for helping you. Well, what did he do?
Jeff Roth is a miracle worker. He's the head of our morgue, which we still have. Unfortunately, we have very few of our paper clippings left. And times past, our digital archive is still not sophisticated enough to capture everything that has been in the paper since 1851. And to me, and I know this is generational, rummaging through the clips in those files, that tactile feel of looking at where a story was in the paper, what kind of headline it had, where the play was, I still get a much better sense of its importance by looking at those clips than I do at a two-dimensional computer screen.
You start with a very unprepossessing building in Queens. Was that in the clips, the New Amsterdam?
The Bound House?
Well, the...
Oh, well, the clips only
the
start...
The Dutch?
No, the clips start in 1851 when the time started, but there are historical references to a lot of those buildings in the times.
We remember the Dutch for their tolerance. How was their attitude codified in the Union of Utrecht?
Well, it's very interesting because I think what made New York different, and frankly still makes New York different from every other place in the country and what was every other colony in the country, was other people came here to escape religious persecution, to proselytize for any other number of reasons. The Dutch came here to make money. And if you didn't get in their way, you were, if you want to be an idealist, you could say you were tolerated. If you want to be more cynical, you could say their attitude toward you was indifference, but you were allowed to get along. You were allowed to come here. Now, different people were treated in different ways.
And Peter Stuyvesant was atypical, would you say? He really had a thing against the Quakers.
He did not like the Quakers.
Quakers.
Well, they weren't so peaceful then. That's why I remember they were called Quakers. They did, you know, quake, literally, like Shakers. They were not what we necessarily think of Quakers today as being friends and peaceful. But, you know, they were supposed to be tolerated. Now, you know, Catholics were not particularly tolerated, Jews, blacks. But the Quakers said to the West India Company, wait a minute, you under the Treaty of New Utrecht are supposed to tolerate us. And the West India Company said to Peter Stuyvesant, no, you've got to tolerate these people. And the reason was, anyone who comes here to try and make money, you accept. And Peter Stuyvesant was reprimanded by the company.
And they were going to Queens?
Yeah.
To Flushing.
Right.
This is before the president started talking about Flushing. What is the Flushing Remonstrance?
Well, it sounds like a homeowner's complaint to a plumber, but it really isn't. This is Some of the neighbors in Flushing sent this remonstrance first to Peter Stuyvesant, then to the West India Company, saying, we are sticking up for our neighbors, the Quakers, because they haven't done anything wrong. And what was so fascinating about that remonstrance, that document, which is now in Albany, is that they said, this was a whole different concept, they said God would be angry if we discriminate against other religions. And this totally defied what was considered religious persecution at the time, that you have to defend your own religion.
And this, one of the defenders of the Quakers, John Bowne, was punished.
Yes, he was. He was punished by Stuyvesant, and he went to the Netherlands and pleaded his case and won and came back. And shortly after that, the English landed in New Amsterdam and, without firing a shot, took over because the Dutch in New Amsterdam had no desire to defend Peter Stuyvesant.
So how does that fit into your story of the history of New York and 27 buildings?
Well, the building is still there. The Bowne House is still there in Flushing. The Friends Meeting House is still there in Flushing. And this becomes emblematic of religious freedom in New York, which made New York different from every other place in the country and made New York different in the 17th century, more than 100 years before the Bill of Rights was passed. And where was it passed? It was passed in New York.
Why did you choose St. Paul's Chapel rather than Trinity Church?
Well, Trinity Church, first of all, burned down in the Great Fire of 1776. St. Paul's Chapel survived. St. Paul's Chapel is where Washington worshipped after he was inaugurated in New York. And there was a continuum about St. Paul's. St. Paul's also survived the collapse of the World Trade Center. Hmm. So here is this monument to New York's resilience, I thought.
And why was it built to face away from Broadway? Was that intended to be symbolic, God turning away from Mammon?
Not really. It just had a better view, interestingly enough. It was facing the Hudson River, and at that point there was nothing in between it and the Hudson River. And it was called a church of convenience at the time because there were people living uptown, believe it or not. That was uptown, and it was easier to get to than Trinity Church.
How did they deal with the American Revolution? Because they were part of the Church of England.
They were indeed, and it became a Tory church. And at the end of the Revolution, it split off, like Trinity, from the Anglican Church and became Episcopalian.
It once was the tallest building in New York.
It was indeed, as was Trinity.
And you mentioned Federal Hall in downtown Manhattan. That only served that function for a very short time. How long was the government of the United States located in New York City?
Well, it's interesting. Federal Hall, or that site, was the city hall of New York for a century, for the entire 17th century. And then in 1789, it became the United States Capitol. Refurbished, became the capital of the United States in 1789 and 1790 before Congress decamped for Philadelphia and then moved ultimately to that swamp on the Potomac. And then,
built by Pierre Charles L'Enfant. But didn't he do work here in New York?
He did indeed. And he refurbished City Hall to make it the national capital. And then City Hall was torn down because it was so decrepit after having been there 100 years. City Hall moved to its present site. It's one of the sites mentioned in the book. It is the oldest functioning, and I use the term functioning loosely, oldest functioning City Hall in the country. And then Federal Hall was built in 1842 as the Custom House, which became symbolic of maritime commerce, which is really what made New York, and then became the sub-treasury and the largest repository of gold in the world and became the symbol of capitalism. So that Federal Hall, which still stands there on Wall Street, becomes a major symbol of democracy, commerce, and capitalism in New York.
Customs, you say. It was doing that during the Civil War?
During
what's the significance of that?
Well, what's significant about customs is that remember, we didn't have an income tax then, so the customs collected in the Port of New York were enough to support the entire federal government at that time.
And there are the Grand Steps. When were they built?
Well, the 18 steps on the Custom House, on Federal Hall, are just an integral part of downtown, in part because there's nowhere else to sit downtown. And also, it's one of those places that is reserved as a freedom of speech spot. Anyone can get up there and say whatever they want under federal law. You can exercise your right to free speech at that spot, which is, of course, the very spot where the Bill of Rights was passed by the first Congress.
And when was the Statue of Washington taking the oath of office installed in front of it?
That was put up in 1883 by the Chamber of Commerce in New York, that larger-than-life statue, which is basically the last thing that happened to Federal Hall. And now it's there's an effort to try and convert it into a celebration of democracy and debate.
You know, getting back to Peter Stuyvesant, he refused to sink a well in the city or New Amsterdam, and his government also allowed a tannery to be built in Manhattan after what you call the first environmental review. Were they at all short-sighted decisions?
Very short-sighted, because the main water was coming from what was called the Collect Pond, which was just north of City Hall, and it became totally polluted, and the water became totally undrinkable.
Well, but north of City Hall would be
Sort of where Foley Square is, just about.
The municipal building.
Yeah, and people couldn't drink the water. They had to sink their own wells, and the aquifer under Lower Manhattan became polluted, too. And Aaron Burr started his own water company, which was a farce and a ruse just to really create a bank. And it wasn't until John Jervis, the engineer, built the Croton Water Works, an amazing system that finally opened in the 1830s, that New York was supplied with fresh water.
But after the Revolution, didn't Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr collaborate on a solution to the problem of water shortage?
Well, Alexander
Hamilton... They were friends at that time.
Alexander Hamilton thought he was collaborating on a solution, but Aaron Burr hoodwinked him, because what Aaron Burr really wanted was to create a bank to rival Alexander Hamilton's bank. And in the legislation, hidden in the legislation, was a clause that any profits from the water company could be used to create a bank. And that became the Bank of the Manhattan Company.
So Hamilton probably should have learned, been warned about
that. I think that was the last time he trusted Aaron Burr.
When was the Croton Reservoir system conceived and built?
Well, that was conceived in the early 1820s and was opened in the 1830s. And it was just a monumental system, mostly fed on gravity, coming from the reservoirs and dams that were created in Westchester. One of the buildings or structures in the book is High Bridge, which carried the water from the Bronx to Manhattan. And it was just an amazing system. And one of the things I learned is that so many buildings, particularly tenements in Manhattan, are six stories because that's how high the gravity feeding pipes.
I always wondered about the six-story
limit. I mean, it wasn't because landlords were concerned that people, you know, would get tired walking to seven stories. It was because that's how far the water would carry by gravity.
And so that was kind of a revolutionary system, wasn't it?
It was remarkable.
John Jervis?
John Jervis was the engineer, and he really could be credited with building that system.
And then when was the reservoir in Central Park built?
It was part of that system put there in Central Park, and then that fed a reservoir in Bryant Park, which was the site of the main library now, and it was this giant sort of Egyptian-looking reservoir that stood at Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street.
And Jervis came up with the idea of conveying water across the Harlem River to Manhattan, as you said. Didn't people protest that bridge?
Well, they didn't like the bridge. They also thought it would block navigation. But it turned out to be a beautiful arch bridge, stone arch bridge. And unfortunately, part of the stone arches were replaced by a steel arch in the 20th century because it proved to be a hazard to navigation.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Send me to work in tall buildings. So it's goodbye to the sunshine. Goodbye to the dew. Goodbye to the flowers. And goodbye to you. I'm off to the subway. I must not be late. Going to work in tall buildings.
I don't want to take too much time away from my conversation with Sam Roberts because, well, he has written a fascinating book, A History of New York in 27 Buildings, the 400-year untold story, largely untold story of an American metropolis. And we will go back to him in just a moment, but a reminder that WBAI is right now in fundraising mode, and we have been giving a lot of our time over to the impeachment hearings, so we couldn't do fundraising then. But I'm asking you for just 2 minutes or so to consider becoming a member of WBAI right now. The need is great. As you probably know, we were off the air for over a month, and we now have to get ourselves back in good shape. Please give us a call, 516-620-3602, or go to our website, WBAI.org, and follow the instructions. Become a member for any amount that is comfortable with you, for you. But if you can see yourself to becoming a sustaining member for $10 a month or more, and that runs until you say stop it, we really would appreciate that because it gives us an opportunity to plan for the future. We call the people who do that BAI buddies. And I hope you'll do it in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. Again, the number 516-620-3602 or go to our website, WBAI.org. And Sam? Let's get back to, I'm not going to get to all these 27 buildings.
Well, I'll tell you a little secret. There are 27 because I miscounted. It was supposed to be 25, and I got carried away, Leonard.
Oh, but I like the idea of 27.
Good.
25 seems too neat.
Okay.
What and where is the Marble Palace?
Oh, the Marble Palace, again, one of my favorites. It's right behind City Hall. Again, like all the others in the book, it still exists. People can visit them. And it was a first department store in the United States. It was built by A.T. Stewart, a Scottish immigrant, and it is all marble. It later became the Sun Building, the newspaper building. It's now occupied by city offices. And it was this beautiful building. People thought, oh, it's too far uptown. It's on the wrong side of Broadway. But Stewart put it there, and he put big glass windows in it, which were unheard of. It was the first building really built as a retail space. And he turned it into this incredibly lucrative department store.
A dry goods store that became a department store.
That's right. And it was called A.T. Stewart's. And he did very, very well.
And you say he was famous even after his death.
He was, because his body was dug up and held for ransom. And frankly, the widow tried to bargain down the kidnappers, which I guess shows this really was a retail family that she came from.
Now, New York may be the home of the first supermarket as well. Bohack, which no longer exists, just like Stewart's store no longer exists, claimed that it was the first supermarket because it was the meat store next, the butcher shop next door closed down, and the customers of the Bohack store in Brooklyn on Broadway said, could you bring in a meat department? And the next thing you knew, there was Bohack covering everything. Later, King Cullen in New Jersey became the first of the really serious supermarket chains. But that's a whole other story. New York is the first in a lot of different things.
When I say
New York, Brooklyn in this case.
Well, there's so many buildings, there's so many places that you pass by and just take for granted and have no idea what part they play in history. One of the buildings in the book, Lexington Avenue, is a great spice store. For instance, 123 Lexington Avenue, and nobody going into that store or passing by the brownstone building would have any idea that this is the only existing building in New York where a president of the United States was inaugurated. Hmm. This was Chester Arthur, who lived there. It was his townhouse. And when they got word that James Garfield had died in New Jersey, Arthur was sworn in as president in the parlor of his house.
The 69th Regiment Armory actually broke new ground architecturally, but we associate it most with the history of modern art.
That's right. It's where the Armory Show was held in 1913.
Now, was it originally just used as a military armory?
Yeah, it was an armory,
a training place
for the 69th Regiment. Like most of the armories in this city, never a shot was fired in anger. But it was most famous for that art show,
1913.
Which really introduced modern art to this country. It had sort of a fledgling presence in Europe, but in this country, people had seen it in a very kind of flat, one-dimensional way in black and white newspaper photos and magazines. But here it was in the flesh, and it stunned people, and it outraged critics, but boy, did it ever take hold.
Well, when you look at the artists who were represented, it really was a very great selection. It was, I don't think any of the major artists of Europe were left out.
No, that's right. It was a great choice.
Picasso, Matisse, Duchamp came here and actually wound up living in New York.
People might not have liked it, but they were certainly stunned by it, and it was a staggering show. And as I say, it really took hold.
I doubt many people are familiar with the significance of Bank of the United States, which is located in the Bronx.
That is one of my favorites. Bank of United States, not Bank of the United States, because
not the Bank of the United
States
right. either.
That's right. The would have made it sound too official, supposedly. But this was an immigrant bank, mostly catering to Jewish immigrants, particularly the Garment Center. It was not pretty well managed in the late 20s and went bust in December of 1930. Milton Friedman said, basically, this is where the Depression began.
He said it was the pebble that triggered an avalanche.
Indeed. This was December 1930. There was a run on the bank. The bank closed. 20,000 people were outside this branch in the Bronx. And the branch, still looking like a bank branch, is still there on Southern Boulevard and Freeman Street.
What's it being used for now?
It's now a laundry. You can think of money laundering, perhaps. But the most amazing or ironic thing to me is you could not get money out of that branch in December 1930.
But
today, there's an ATM in the laundromat, and you can put your card in and take cash out.
But how did a run on a Bronx bank wind up playing such a significant role in the Depression?
Well, Milton Friedman, for one, and there are others who agree, say that the big banks refused to bail out Bank of the United States because it was owned by Jews and catered to immigrant Jews. There's probably no way of ever actually proving that. But because that bank was allowed to fail and had hundreds of thousands of depositors, it triggered a unrest and unease, which led to other bank failures, and that certainly contributed to the Depression.
We think of theater as being a major part of the city's lifeblood. Why and when was it banned along with prize fighting for many years?
Well, it was banned, certainly burlesque theater, vaudeville theater, and you know, people just thought it was one of those naughty things that should not be open to the public.
LaGuardia banned it, didn't
right? LaGuardia did. Also, Sunday baseball was banned, believe it or not. That's one of the things that...
And you couldn't buy beer on a Sunday.
That's right. That's one of the things that got Jimmy Walker elected and reelected. You know, forget about all the things he did that people thought were wrong. That was enough to make people love him. One of the structures in the book is the Apollo Theater, which originally opened not for blacks in Harlem. They weren't allowed in it. But whites went to Harlem to see black entertainment.
In fact, that much of the entertainment in the Cotton Club and all of that was segregated. Black people were forced to sit in a separate place, but the entertainers were all black.
That's right.
Yeah. And when did that change?
That changed only in the late 20s and early 30s, and not before that. And one of the things I point out in the book is how Harlem changed from white to black. And very interestingly, and something I never knew, it was the result of what we would now call blockbusting, but blockbusting by black realtors, not by whites. And they took what whites had been doing and, you know, used it against them.
The things that we were talking about earlier were all based on religious considerations. Did anybody talk about the fact that there was separation of church and state?
Not really.
So was one church, the Catholic Church, or some Protestant group behind it?
It was interesting because when you look at the construction of St. Patrick's Cathedral, for instance, that was the church in the early mid-19th century, really sticking it in the eye of the Protestants in New York, building this mammoth, massive, beautiful, majestic cathedral right up on Fifth Avenue.
Well, there was an earlier St. Patrick's right, on Elizabeth was, Street.
That's in, right, the old St. Patrick's.
What is now Chinatown.
But putting or this one...
No, what is it? So, NoHo.
Putting this one right on Fifth Avenue and 50th Street, 49th Street, said to the Protestants, hey, you know, we're here and we're here to stay.
We think of theater, of course, as being Midtown, but didn't it start downtown?
It's definitely started downtown. George Washington went to theater when he was president in very lower Manhattan, around Wall Street. There was theater then.
And there was a riot in Astor Place?
Yes, the Astor Place riot, because... people were either supporting an English actor playing Shakespeare or an American actor playing Shakespeare. It's hard to believe there was that degree of passion over theater. And what it was really about was not so much about theater, but about something we're still dealing with today, about nativists versus immigrants. Hmm. Things have unfortunately not changed in 200 or more years.
What brought the theater up to the Midtown area?
Well, everything...
Not that we don't have some theaters still downtown.
Well, everything went to Midtown. It's fascinating because when you think of 1811 and the commissioners of New York City, the street commissioners said, you know, Manhattan is developing in a totally haphazard way. We've got to map out the development. When they did that in 1811, North Street in Manhattan was Houston Street. And they said, we're going to map out Manhattan all the way to 155th Street. Now, that was either, you know, audacious or bold or prescient. So they did that. And in fact, they were absolutely right, because Manhattan kept creeping up higher and higher. One of the things in the book is Grand Central Terminal. And that ultimately, in the beginning of the 19th century, shifted the center of gravity of Manhattan from downtown to Midtown. So you see this progression of development going from the very tip of Lower Manhattan with the Dutch, moving inexorably the Empire State Building, Midtown, Times Square, Rockefeller Center, Lincoln Center, all of this movement along the spine of Manhattan going higher and higher.
One of the great mysteries of New York for many people is how H-O-U-S-T-O-N is pronounced Houston and not Houston.
Well, it's not named after Sam Houston.
It's named after Houston. Wasn't it originally H-A-U-S-T-E-N and just misspelled?
It may well have been, but whoever it was, his name was Mr. Houston, not Mr. Houston.
So When did New York Theater become a place for trial runs to work out productions before they were sent out on tour?
It probably did in the late 20s or so. And one of the buildings in the book, the Lyric Theater, is the oldest still operating theater in the city. And it was just famous for the productions it had. And as I say, it's still there.
And so is the Lyceum Theater, which you write about.
And the Lyceum, exactly.
Who was the architect there?
I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly. Mm. But it was built by the family that controlled most of the theaters before the Schuberts did.
Charles and Daniel Frohman?
That's right, the Frohmans. And Charles, unfortunately, died in the sinking of the Lusitania.
So what production opened the Lyceum, and were the critics excited that this new theater was opening a new production?
Well, they were more excited about the theater than they were about the production. The production, as I recall, got mixed reviews. The theater got terrific reviews because it was just so beautiful, both the facade and the interior. The Frohmans really spared no expense on the theater, and it just was one of the things that moved the theater district from sort of the Flatiron area up to Times Square.
I'm speaking with Sam Roberts about his latest book, A History of New York in 27 Buildings, published by Bloomsbury. We mentioned earlier that one of the buildings you list here is the Coney Island Boardwalk. How did that become a candidate for this book, and how was Maxim Gorky involved in Coney Island? Maxim Gorky, the father of social realism?
Exactly. Well, he thought Coney Island was about the best thing he had seen in New York. And it was this place of dreams. And the reason I included the boardwalk, and again, every structure, every building in this book was put there for a symbol of some sort of transcendence in the city. And the boardwalk was important for one major reason. And the reason is it democratized the beach. We forget.
Is there anything like it anywhere else in the world?
Well,
I mean, there are boardwalks.
Atlantic
elsewhere.
City has a longer one, but I don't think any other boardwalk had the same sort of impact. We forget that the beach in New York by the end of the 19th century was largely private. Manhattan Beach, Brighton Beach were all the purviews of private hotels, of racetracks, of the rich. And it was the subway at the very beginning of the 19th century and then the boardwalk in the late teens and early 20s that opened up the beaches of New York to all those people who were cramped and stuck in the slums of Manhattan.
And Maxim Gorky wrote about it. Sigmund Freud had his thoughts. And the New York Times wrote about it. What was the reaction at the time?
Well, it was celebrated as this great public event, this great public opening that made this accessible to the masses. And it was, you know, just one of these great wonders of the world.
And then didn't the chief engineer, Philip Farley, have conflicts with Robert Moses?
Yes. Like everybody else in New York, he had conflicts with Moses.
This is a young Robert Moses.
A young Robert Moses, a still idealistic Robert Moses. And the chief engineer did a great job and actually built this boardwalk and built it for the people. And it was it still remains the second longest boardwalk in the world. Now, you know, arguably it's not made of boards anymore, at least not wooden boards for the most part. But it is still a great boardwalk and still attracts every sort of person. And again, is as democratic as anything can be in the world.
It also cuts across an incredible area, all of the rides and the other businesses, the food and the like of Coney Island. Coney Island is like no other place in the world.
It really is. And now the Cyclones are there, and Nathan's is still there, and the expanded aquarium is there. And you have these enclaves of...
What did Moses want to do? I'm sorry.
He wanted to build it up in a way that would not have made it as open as it is today. And, you know, the fact that the public housing is there really limited the ability to develop it as it could have been.
He did have plans to limit access to poor people and to people of color to any number of places. He wanted the bridges that were over the highways to Jones Beach to be low enough so that buses couldn't
take
people in.
That's right, as Bob Carroll pointed out in The Power Broker.
We don't have time to tell some of the other fascinating stories in this book, particularly one that I was hoping to get to, the Ash Building, because it has so many different histories.
Well, if the Bank of United States Building in the Bronx was where the Depression started, the Ash Building in Washington Square arguably is where the New Deal started. Francis Perkins, who was having tea right across Washington Square Park, was there when the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire began in the Ash Building, and she raced across the park. That fire obviously resulted in all sorts of worker protection, safety legislation, and she later said, and she became Secretary of Labor under FDR, Frances Perkins said, that is when the New Deal began.
Ladies, what is it?
The ILGWU, the
International Ladies Garment Workers Union, comes out of that as well. Now, I'm sure that people have said and wondered why some buildings haven't made it, and I'm going to mention a few. The Woolworth Building, the Chrysler Building, the Dakota Apartments, Tammany Hall, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Hamilton Grange, Francis Tavern,
the RCA building.
The RCA
what,
building.
What we will still call the RCA building.
Now, you say you planned originally just 25, wound up with 27. Did you just stop because you had gotten to 27, or were there reasons that those buildings, and I would have also thrown in the Morris Jamel Mansion, why those buildings didn't make the cut?
Well, I stopped because I was supposed to stop at 25 and got carried away. Maybe there'll be in a sequel.
Oh, are you thinking of doing it?
Well, if there's a demand, I certainly would.
Well, can I vote?
Yes. Well, in the back of the book, there's an email address, and I invite people to vote, in fact.
And what is the email address?
It's 27buildingsnyc at gmail.com.
Now, we have just a few more minutes left. Are there any other favorites that I should have asked you about?
Well, one of my favorites is the American Banknote Building in the Bronx also. And this is the South Bronx, the poorest neighborhood in the country. And the American Banknote Building was a printing plant. The building is still there. The printing plant shut down in the late 80s. But there they were printing billions of dollars in currency, and nobody knew about it. And this was in the poorest section of the United States.
And now it's all printed in Washington?
It's being printed in various places. The company still exists. A lot of it is being printed in other parts of the country. But they were printing food stamps, postage stamps, foreign currency, and being shipped out of that building right in the South Bronx.
And what happened?
Nobody knew that all of this money, all of this wealth was being generated literally in their backyard.
But, I mean, then the building got closed down by the government?
No, it got closed down by American Banknote, and they just moved to either a safer neighborhood or where they could find cheaper labor.
Uh-huh. Even though it's a really poor neighborhood. You also have illustrations in this book?
Yep, sort of before and after illustrations.
So that we can see how these buildings were planned and how they changed?
Indeed. And what they look like today.
Are any of them pretty much what they were when they first
built?
Well,
yeah, if you look at things like Empire State, like the Flatiron Building, like the Bossert Hotel where the Dodgers celebrated the World Series. High Bridge, of course, is somewhat different. But it's fascinating to see how some of them still look the same and how some have unfortunately been radically altered.
And some have, as we said earlier, been totally destroyed. I really thought it was something, a desecration, even though I'm not a Yankees fan, when they took down Yankee Stadium. It was one of the most important stadiums historically in all of baseball history.
Absolutely
true. The house that Ruth built.
That's right. And Steinbrenner unbuilt.
And is New York just simply driven by the economics of whether a site is a good place to have a building or not?
Well, yeah, because unlike cities in the southwest and the south, you know, we can't annex more land. We stopped doing that pretty much in 1898.
We can't steal any of Westchester or Nassau County?
Unless, you know, they won't have us. So the only place we can go is up, as we're doing.
Sam Roberts when will we see you on television?
Every week on CUNY TV.
And then you also have the podcast, which is probably access to all of the ways you normally get podcasts, and a whole bunch of books.
Yep.
And we see you in the New York Times regularly. And now this book, I hope there's a sequel, A History of New York in 27 Buildings, The 400-Year Untold Story of an American Metropolis, published by Bloomsbury. What a great pleasure it's been having you on our show today.
Leonard, my pleasure, and thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to Fran Higgins, who produced today's segment, and to Kevin O'Donohue and Nesima Dimar of the Positive Mind Center for allowing us to use their first-rate studio facilities. If you're new to the show and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org or available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter. Also, our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com, where you can find links to all of our past shows. I hope you will tune in tomorrow when Alvin and Lawrence Ubell will be here and be taking your calls. See you tomorrow. And as I said earlier, our pledge line is active once again, so why not show your support for Leonard Lopate at Large by making a donation of any amount right now by calling 516-620-3602 or by going to our website, WBAI.org. In the past, we have told you about all of the expenses that we have at the station, expenses that you would expect, phones, equipment, rent, electricity, and also we have to pay for our antenna. But ever since WBAI was knocked off the air for a month by a rogue faction at the Pacifica Network, the need has become even greater. We need your help just to get our facilities back to the level that they were before the station takeover. And we need all of our listeners to step up and show their support to keep the quality of Leonard Lopate at Large up to the standards that our listeners expect and to make sure that this show is never interrupted again. The best way to do that is to make a contribution of any amount that you can. If you can see a way to becoming a BAI buddy by making a sustaining monthly donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, you can do that by going to our website, WBAI.org, or by calling 516-620-3602. People usually choose to become sustaining members for $10 a month because they don't see that as all that much money coming out of their account each month, but it adds up and it really helps us to plan for the future. And every amount, in fact, helps whether you're becoming a sustaining member or making a one-time contribution. Whatever level you can contribute at, the important thing is to step up and give. Thank you again from all of us at Leonard Lopate at Large for your generous support, and we'll see you tomorrow.